Hello and welcome to our very first episode of the Mad Tech Podcast in 2020. Happy New Year to all our listeners, except those that obviously celebrate Chinese New Year. Happy New Year to you in a few weeks. With me today, I have...
Can't say it in Chinese, no?
I can't say it in Chinese. No, I'm sorry. I've failed you. Okay. I'm really sorry. If you hadn't guessed already, with me today, I have our CEO of ExchangeWire, Kieran O'Kane.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And our special guest today is Anthony Rind, COO of Beamly. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Here we are in 2020. It's a whole new year.
The 20s. And
nothing happening in the news outside of advertising technology at all at the moment.
No news.
No news.
At all. Very quiet,
yes.
Actually.
What are you talking about? It's an absolute shit show right now. Let's picture the bones of that carcass right now.
I think Harry and Meghan are going to work for an ad tech company.
Oh my God! Oh, they're going to start an ad network. I reckon it could be a niche royal ad network. And they could aggregate other royal celebrity websites and then go to the agencies. Meghan will be in there doing trading deals with Robin.
Well, they're going to Canada, right? Do you think they'll start working with Index Exchange? Do you think they'll have a chat with Andrew?
Canada, that's
right
what
now?
They were setting up in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah. Probably.
They need an ad tech layer.
Some speculation.
Anything
could be true.
Harry
right now.
To speak at ATS this year about his new his verticalized ad network.
Another ginger.
Yeah. Ginger's on stage.
Right, I'm going to kick off.
Blonde, right?
You're blonde.
Yeah, it's blonde colour.
You are not. You're anything but blonde. Right. I'm sorry, Kieran, to break it to you.
I'm very Scandi looking.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, obviously the Finnish looking north, the country, not the blondes.
You're Nordic.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you are. Of course you are. Anyway, I want to kick off talking about M&A, of which there has been a plenty, not just this week, but actually kind of Q4 in general was very busy in 2019. So back end of last year, 19th of December, it was announced that Rubicon Project and Telaria are combining in a stock-for-stock merger with their eyes probably full with dollar signs, firmly on the CTV market. They're looking to create the trade desk of the sell side. And from a financial perspective, Rubicon's markup on the day of the announcement was 283 million. Telaria's is 250 million. So very sort of level pegging. Then we had a nice little quiet break over the holidays. And then on Monday, boom, Tremor International announced it's reached an agreement with News Corp to acquire Unruly. Just want to, before we get into that news, I want to kind of unpick who Tremor International is now, because for those of you that think it's Tremor Video,
we can whiteboard
you're
this.
Very wrong. Actually, it should be whiteboarded because it's very, me too. Very complicated. So, complicated M&A in this industry. Right, rundown. Tremor International is not Tremor Video. It started as Marie Media in 2007, and its tech platform was called AdGadget, which then became Kadabra. In 2014, it purchased Taptica. It first acquired a purchase option and listed on the AIM, which is the alternative investment market, which is part of the London Stock Exchange, in case you weren't aware of the fact that Taptica or Marie Media and Rhythm One, we'll get onto that later, are both listed, were both listed on the AIM, if you didn't even know what the AIM was. So it could fund the purchase option. It then officially acquired Taptica in 2014. Not long after that, it issued a profit warning. It closed its platform, Kadabra, and focus solely on Taptica.
And then it reopened name. Abra?
Very good. Reopened
Backed
Abra.
By the kebab chain in Ireland.
It is a kebab, it's got Abracadabra. Great stuff, in fairness.
You can't hear me. I just had sound guy come over to turn my microphone around. It's going well. Good start to 2020. It then officially changed its name to Taptica. So there's a trend here. It then acquired Area One and a majority stake in Japanese company Ad Innovation. It then acquired Tremor Video's DSP for $50 million in 2017. Tremor Video's SSP was then renamed to Telaria. Telaria obviously has now just merged with Rubicon. And the fact that Rubicon have the controlling stake just about in that means that Telaria name could cease to exist.
Ruby Telaria. Rubilaria, I like that one.
And then in February this year, Taptica merged with Rhythm One. And in June, it renamed itself to Tremor International.
Wow. What a mess.
Tremor International has acquired Unruly. News Corp will take 6.91% of Tremor International stock, along with a total minimum revenue guarantee for News Corp of £30 million. For context, it bought Unruly for around £58 million. So, lots of information.
£58 million?
Pounds. Yeah. I mean, initial reports were that it would be about 114 million, but I think eventually it went through for over 58 million. But I mean, lots to unpick firstly about M&A. M&A in general, Q4 has been very, very busy. If we look at, and 2019 was fairly busy. We look at the demise of Seismic and then eventually the ad server being bought by Amazon. We also need to look at the Taboola Outbrain merger. There is Roku buying DataXu. Blackstone bought Vungle. So it's very, very busy. Q4 was the busiest it's been for many, many years. Do we think that will continue into 2020? We've already had one big major announcement this year. Are we expecting this year to look quite crazy on the M&A scene? Anthony, I'm going to start with you.
That was very impressive, Lindsay.
Thank you. I need a breather now.
Yeah, I must admit, I think it's extremely confusing, and that's half the problem. I think if you have advertising budgets, working out where to spend it and who to spend it through and to understand the commercial model of that person you're spending it through is critical. I think that the other macro factor that we need to be aware of is that whilst the digital area of advertising spend continues to grow, when you look into that, the growth has been driven by Google and Facebook. And the non-Google Facebook space, which maybe we can call simplistically the open web, is actually declining. And I looked at Michael Barrett's statements of the goals for this transaction, and it was to be a lower priced player, a scaled player, and an efficient player in, as he put it, a time when the market is contracting. So I think that's the context. There's an increasingly difficult space, and I think a lot of the alignments are because they're trying to make it simpler for themselves to have scale and for advertisers to execute at scale. And I think with this difficult time, that's why the prices at a headline level don't seem particularly attractive. Obviously, Telaria and Ruby was a merger, and the price of the acquisition of Unruly was at a headline level below what it sold for 4 years ago.
Mm. Kieran, continue those thoughts.
So, go back to Anthony's point. Yeah, is it happening because of a shrinking market, or is it just economies of scale and simplicity of it all? That makes sense. You know, if Telaria and Rubicon merge, then you've got a really powerful footprint in display advertising and a fairly powerful footprint in CTV, and you combine that, that's a very, very attractive proposition to not only broadcasters but to web-based publishers. I just think more of this is going to happen. I just think there's too many players in the middle, and consolidation was inevitable. And I think that if you look at the sort of bigger existential crisis in the space, which is ID and identity and ITP, that feeds into this as well. Like, if you have one platform, you can operate, you can activate a first party cookie across that platform, and it just makes more sense in terms of opt-in and users and all the rest of it, measurement, etc. So it just makes it's simplicity, right? If you want a scaled Facebook, Google proposition, you need something on a similar line. But, the Telaria Rubicon company will probably end up being a billion market cap, which is pretty decent sized company. And then what happens to the rest of the SSPs? Like, there's a ton of them still out there. But my sense is the online display is really difficult. Really, really difficult for anybody outside of Google and Facebook. Facebook is its own entity, right? But Google is basically the web, right? Because of Chrome. And whatever changes they make on the ITP stuff, they'll effectively become the GPL, the Google programmatic layer. So where you had the cookie, which enabled all these companies to operate independently, it just doesn't happen anymore. And the ironic thing is, like, we'll probably get this in the third story, but it's the money is swinging back to like managed service and IOs. And actually, agencies probably want to work with the horizontal players like Facebook, Google, Snap, whoever else is at scale. And then they'll have specific niche players who have a vertical focus, whether it's healthcare or auto or financial or whatever. And that's where probably the opportunity is for the next wave of ad tech. So maybe this is the end of the scaled ad tech era. We'll head into an era where we'll have companies probably worth 50, 60 million, like you know, the optimal level of 60 to 100 or 200 million, whatever, but they would probably be more managed service businesses. They'll probably be more quasi-agency, quasi-ad network type.
Can I be slightly contrarian, Kira?
Go ahead.
I don't think that there is a swing towards I.O. I think there may be more I.O. happening in the open web space. But again, if we look at Google and Facebook and Amazon, which is growing as an advertising space, all of these are through platforms, UIs. Again, I think this is where some of the companies have struggled a little bit. So again, Tremor has just bought Unruly, obviously because of the supply that it's going to get from Footprint. News Corp. Tremor was sold as the DSP to be an independent DSP, and it was going into that incredibly cluttered space. But essentially, if you look at Teads, they've got what's called a DSP as well, but essentially it's not sold as a DSP, it's just a platform to buy the Teads inventory. And Power Editor is the platform to buy the Facebook inventory, and AdWords or DBM is the platform to buy Google inventory. So the reality is the use of platforms is growing, as we're seeing from the fact that more and more money is going into the walled gardens. It's just the component that isn't in those walled gardens that is fragmented so badly that to buy it through platforms means you're managing so many platforms that are complicated, high friction to set up and use, that it's simpler to give it in an IO basis. So again, I think it's more symptomatic of the fact that the independent display space is under so much pressure. It's not growing, potentially the opposite, depending on what data that you're looking at. And there's so many different intermediary layers that have to be operated through, not just the bidding tech, but the measurement tech, the validation, the verification tech. It's just
a mess.
High friction.
Yeah.
So what do you think it should look like? Because actually, you're making a really excellent point there. Kind of Teads has a DSP. Tremor International is a DSP. It's now buying supply back. So it's now kind of going back into supply side space again. Actually, the labels that we have for these companies no longer really apply.
No.
So what should we be looking at? Does the Lumascape mean nothing anymore?
I think what you're looking at...
It's collapsing on itself, I think.
I just think it's interesting for those of us that are interested in this space. But for a brand marketer or even a performance marketer...
If you're the
marketer,
person doing the buying...
It's just confusing.
Yeah, how do you even navigate it?
So again, I think the reason that we know certain players have been successful in that open market space is because they've had recognizable supply, ideally unique supply, that advertisers see working or want to see working. So again, I think what we need to have is the brands want to buy something they recognize. I think this is where some of the companies that are emerging, let's use Spotify as an example, what they're doing is really interesting because you know what you're buying. What you're buying is music, lifestyle, audio with some video, but you're essentially buying Spotify. It's easy to describe what that is to a brand. Whereas if you're saying I'm buying Telaria or I'm buying Tremor or I'm buying Unruly, it doesn't mean anything unless you're really in the weeds. And so, again, there's a lovely ecosystem that we love to be part of, but you've got to translate it into the brand team that's looking at cross-media and then melt a number of layers within digital that they're wanting to put together on a plan and understand its purpose. And there isn't an accessibility to a lot of this. And I think, so what we need to create is accessibility to the brand marketer. And I think, again, News Corp is a recognizable platform. So Tremor and Unruly coming together is great if it has that unique supply of News Corp inventory. It means it's going to have to be considered for anyone looking to advertise to broad audiences in the UK, in Australia, in the US. That's a positioning.
Mm. I agree. Okay, I'll come back to you on that, right? So there's a couple of things to unpick here. Because it's if you think about the way that media has been transacted, right? It's still important in this part of the world, maybe not so much in the US, to own the demand, right? If you look at the likes of MediaIQ and Captive Fire and all this, they own the demand, right? They have an IO transaction with the agency or whoever, and they execute on their behalf, right? And I think that's where a lot of the middle ground is going to shift to, right? So platforms, the amount of, as Anthony said, the complexity within display is insane, right? It's, if you're a marketer, it's like, why am I bothering with this? It's like, I think what we're heading towards is more of a platform-esque environment, right? Walled gardens are going to be everywhere, right? And the ones who win in the new environment are the ones who have first-party data, right? So then, who is left in ad tech world to enable that. So it's enablers. And how many do you need? Right. If you've no cookie, then you can't really arbitrage and get involved in the whole process because that's gone, right? With ITP and GDPR and all the rest of it, it just becomes harder to be that. So you're going to have a wave of companies kind of disappearing from that space. And the complexity in display is going to happen.
But when that wave of companies disappears, won't a whole new wave of companies come in their place and confuse things even more?
I don't think so, because the consolidation within that middle ground is going to happen. It's going to be a bit like, it's almost a bit like how the stock market works. There's one centralized platform, yeah, or a bunch of platforms, and then all the other stuff is done around the periphery, right? I'm not saying that IOs are back, but there's certainly going to be a lot more managed service because, as Anthony said, the complexity now, if there's 1,000 walled gardens, it's going to be almost impossible for a buyer to can navigate that world without help from a third party, right? Whether that's a managed service or whether that's a platform to API and engage in, right? There is definitely a future for ad tech, but it's not the future it's not the decade we had before, right? Where we have 50 fucking SSPs and 50 DSPs. We just don't need that. I think what we'll see, and you know, you can quote me on this, we're going to have probably 3 scale DSPs by the end of the year, right? And DBM is one of them, and the Trade Desk is another, and then another, maybe 2. I don't know who they would be. And then you're going to have probably the likes of Taboola and Outbrain kind of consolidating the native market, right? That's their objective. And then you've got your SSPs, the likes of Telaria and Rubicon, then become that like sort of layer up for publishers and monetization and broadcasters. And it's a non-Google option. And then after that, what do you need? Like, so you've got Google then. Like, so, you know, a lot of the ad networks might just use the Google infrastructure and say, we'll buy, please, Mr. Ad Network, buy on our behalf. And they'll layer in some analytics and layer in some bits and pieces the way MediaIQ does. And you'll have entities like that. But this is a game changer. There's another big deal apparently on the block, and we can't say who it is, but there's rumors swirling around.
The deal changer was when data ceased to be fluid. There was a whole logic for an independent ad tech enablement layer that was independent if you were a supply side, or independent if you were demand side, and then or independent in the middle where the supply side tech and the demand side tech could meet in an independent context. So there were 3 different independent realms. A few people tried to sit across those, but it was always compromised to a degree. But then suddenly, with the lack of ability to operate with an independent data set because of ITP, GDPR, now the Californian Consumer Privacy Act that came into force on the start of this month, we really don't have clarity on where that goes. And that squashed that value of independence, because then you want an integrated data set with the supply side that can bring it to a demand side that then, with your clean data rooms, can in a safe way connect the data sets. And then there's the whole economics that spiraled of the cost of managing an independent data infrastructure if you were on the brand side, because everyone felt they needed one, but they didn't understand the costs and complexity associated. It spiraled, and a lot of people have spent money that's not proved to be a good investment, partly because of the regulation shifts, and partly because they didn't know how to effectively commission or build the right technology, because it was such a new space that people didn't necessarily understand the outcome goals when they were going into that commissioning process. And I think that's why there's been so much money spent by companies on all parts of the ecosystem in the last 5 years that may not end up having a great value. It'll be written off at some point.
Interesting. I think this is a good opportunity for us to actually, I'm going to jump to question 3 for the purposes of Kieran and Anthony, who know what that means, because we've talked about it briefly just now. So an article at AdExchanger which says the future of ad tech will be a return to vertical. Kieran, you mentioned earlier, we've been operating in a horizontal world for a very, very long time, and actually everything has been targeted for everybody by everybody. Is there a world where potentially we could see the return of the vertical ad network? Meaning that a company focuses just on travel, just on pharma, just on finance, and targets only those companies or companies that need that kind of data. It's how things used to operate, and it used to work very, very well. Obviously, as scale happened, everything broadened out. But the beauty of this, of course, is vertical ad tech still needs horizontal ad tech to survive. So is there a world where actually horizontal could be engaging more in trying to either build or buy or license vertical ad networks that focus just on a specific industry and try to build and grow and scale that way, looking at all the different opportunities that exist from a data perspective, from an efficiency, economy as a scale perspective. What are people's thoughts on this? Anthony, I'm going to kick off with you.
So I think vertical has always been critical. Is successful if it has a unique data set, of course. But it also is successful if it has expert practitioners that understand the industry. So it's not just the tech and the data. You've got to have people, which is why there are specialist agencies and specialist publishers that have people that understand the goals of the budgets they're chasing. So the vertical space is very healthy and will continue to be healthy. I think for a while we had a vision of a view of a consumer that was enriched. So we would take holiday data and sell the fact that someone was a frequent flyer in business class to BMW as a propensity signal to make them use that data and not necessarily the inventory.
Yeah.
And that was the whole premise behind DMPs and CDPs and getting an enriched consumer profile. That doesn't go away. It gets harder in the current context. But that vertical business still ran very effectively, whether or not it was finance, whether or not it was travel, whether or not it was pharma. Again, regulations in different markets mean pharma is much more mature in the US than it is outside of the US, very although, true. Again, lower regulation in Asia, big growth opportunities. So I think vertical still exists. The question is, does vertical become a network of intelligence about consumers, which is what we've been running at for the last 10 years and is now looking less relevant as a proposition?
And the answer to that question is?
Will it expand? I think it's already there. Will it continue? Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Mm. Kieran?
Yes. I think that the vertical plays are going to be important going forward. So I had a conversation with someone over beers before Christmas about this very thing, and he was saying a horizontal tech just doesn't work for some of the publishers now or for buyers because of these restrictions about ID matching and all the rest of it. So, you know, the use of data and the segmentation, it just doesn't make any sense anymore. And it's going to be, people would sort of bemoan, oh, this is the end of independent ad tech, but I don't think so. I believe that Anthony's correct. You just can't just wade into a vertical and go, I have expertise, I know this, I know that. When all you have is some data, when all you have is like data and tech, but yeah. You don't understand the nuances of the, you know, you don't understand the nuances of the publishers you work with or the audience you're trying to sell. And there's no doubt that a buyer will use Google, will use Facebook to access at scale these targeted users. But then there's going to be budget pots of budget available for people who's like, you know, if I have an exclusive golf audience, right, and I aggregate golfing sites, high net worth individuals that investment banks want to be at, or, you know, luxury good companies want to be at, like, there's an opportunity there. Whether or not that would be attractive to the VC community or if it's scalable enough is another day's crack. Maybe that this is the way things are going to pan out, that this space becomes less interesting for investors because a lot of the innovation, a lot of the consolidation is already happening, the maturity of the industry. There are other areas of media that are still there to be disrupted and evolved. Out of home is a good one, which is another story today. Gaming, still interesting. TV, CTV. So there are loads of opportunities. It just, I always think of from an online display perspective. I mean, the open web browser-based display, that's a challenge space. So then where do you add value if Google and Facebook can do most of this stuff, particularly Google, because Google let's be honest, Google is the open web, and whatever changes they make to Chrome is going to help Google, right? I mean, that's the reality. It's a zero-sum game. You can't win Google. You have to figure out a way to live with them as opposed to compete with them. You know, we've had people who try to do that. Brian O'Kelly, he sold his company to AT&T and fucked off to some, logistics startup. Maybe he saw the writing on the wall, I don't know. But I'm not picking it, painting a gloomy picture. I'm just saying it's a recalibration of what we do and what value we add.
I think that's fair, but I think looking at the vertical and what value vertical can bring to publishers and to buyers as well, looks at that recalibration in some ways. Like, yes, it's not particularly attractive to VCs in terms of trying to build the next unicorn.
Who cares?
But actually, there could be slow and steady growth there, particularly if looking at verticals and the growth in verticals is a way that you can get around regulatory challenges, and you start planning in a more vertical sense than maybe you were before, where you were looking at things more broadly. And then that means that you've got opportunity for scale that way, and publishers can tap into that more easily than they could in the past.
Yeah.
But also it means that there's a wealth of offline data that can be brought, because if you've got vertical expertise, you can bring in the offline data into that area as well, and that actually enriches that user somewhat more. Obviously, companies like LiveRamp have been doing that for years, and sort of bringing offline data, sort of third-party data, onto the web to try and make it targetable by buyers. But I think there's vertical opportunity from that perspective, but it's slow.
But again, just going back to the advertiser perspective, vertical has always been there.
Mm.
The challenge with vertical is if you were only focusing on vertical, you were limited by the supply of audience in the vertical channel or the supply of profiles in the vertical data set. So again, if you had aspirations to try and conquest or chase market entrance or diversify into a new space, then it required you to go broader, and this is obviously where the likes of profile partners, frankly, is a Google or a Facebook. For a number of years, Criteo was incredibly successful in networking the intelligence they had to also have cross vertical domain data sets and expertise. It's more of the same. I don't think there's any great shift. So, you know, I think you're seeing companies like Sojourn doing brilliantly and growing really well, expanding geographically.
For those that aren't aware about Sojourn, they specialize in the travel vertical.
So the ticket information they have, they have a unique data set.
They've done data partnerships with a very broad set of travel companies, and it's a symbiotic ecosystem. I think the technology, the ad tech, is enabling all sorts of companies. Again, I just think that what we're seeing at the moment is the independent ad tech marketplace being compromised. The ad tech is still operating, whether or not it's inside Google, inside Sojourn. It's evolving in companies like Criteo or whoever will become the next Criteo, in the same way as before Criteo there was advertising.com. It's just cyclical. It's a marketplace that's going to shift, but it doesn't mean the marketplace for verticals is any different in terms of its relevancy. It's just its way of operating will change based on regulation and technology.
Yeah. And there's, there's business practices there as well that you need to sort of get your head around. I mean, I could argue that I like the cyclical aspect to that argument there. You can say the last 10 years are about that, but now it's kind of a reshifting of where things were. It's more a case about the evolution of the cookie, right? The piece of JavaScript that enabled a lot of this stuff and how it's just not functional anymore. And it's like, I have a lot of friends in the industry who kind of like a rage against the dying light. Like, I find it kind of depressing sometimes when they're just kind of going, yes, we can save this problem. The IAB rocks down to this ICO. We can solve this problem. I'm going, who gives a shit? Like, because ultimately you don't have any power. It's Chrome. It's Firefox. It's Safari. You know, like, even if Chrome sort of allows us to continue, you're just going to cut off 50% of the world's mobile market, or even, you know, like, it's just, I think the rules have changed and we just have to evolve around it. That's more or less kind of...
I think one of the other macro factors that we mustn't ignore again is the device, the role played by the device and the consumer device preferences. Because if you look at the last 10 years, it's been dominated by the iPhone. And then the flanker to the iPhone is obviously Android operating system. But the share of mobiles going to a non-Apple device is still shockingly low in the... In the most mature advertising marketplaces, and then you have Android dominating everywhere else because it's a free operating system. But until somebody invents a device that consumers prefer to an iPhone,
then there are going to be massive constraints. If somebody comes in with a device that competes with the iPhone, that has a different attitude to Apple, and maybe decides to not use an Android operating system, we're going to be stuck with an Apple advertising attitude and a Google advertising attitude, dominating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And within the chaos, this opportunity is, you have to think harder. It's just not easy. Easy route to money anymore.
On that note, talking of easy route to money, let's go to our third story, which is an article by the FT, which says that for the first time ever since records began, outdoor advertising is poised to eclipse newspapers. Now, this is not, I must clarify, print in general. It's just newspapers. But out of home accounts for 6.5% of the $600 billion global advertising market. And stands as the only traditional media platform that continues to grow as others give ground to Google and Facebook, which in and of itself is a stat to reckon with. 20 years ago, newspapers and magazines captured $4 in every $10 of media spent. This year, advertisers will spend $40.6 billion on outdoor posters and street furniture, as it's called, which is about $4 billion more than on newspapers. And the stats came from Group M, and they reckon that by 2024, out of home will exceed spends on both newspapers and magazines combined. As it stands, despite like a flat economy in Britain, actually out of home grew 8% in Britain last year. So that again is an interesting statistic, because it does show his opportunity there. And the opportunity really is coming from digital. Digital is what is transforming this the out of home medium. But obviously it's also fascinating what it looks like from market by market perspective, because out of home is definitely a medium where each different market acts very, very differently.
But again, let's be careful, because we are all of us digital savants in our B2B lives. But what's happening in out of home in this decade is digital innovation. What was happening in out of home in the last two decades was format innovation. So
that's,
it was backlights,
true.
It was skins,
yep.
It was lentroscopics, it was all sorts of specials. And that pulled money into out of home. Out of home has a great history of innovating. It also has an exceptional ability historically to limit supply by packaging inventory, by ensuring that the spectaculars needed to be bought, or the proximity to store sites needed to be bought in packages. So there was always a mixture, again, a network management of the way that out of home was bought, which has been very effectively managed on the supply inventory side to manage its share of budgets. It's an incredibly integrated marketplace. It's also very high investment. So again, building the digital sites we've all have read is very expensive. But even before that, if you were in the out-of-home space, you had to win the contract to have the signage. So you had to build the out-of-home furniture, which meant the bus shelter, which meant sometimes the seats for people to sit on in public areas that were paid for by the ads that were adjacent to them. So again, there's a very high capital long-term investment. There's very competitive bidding processes for these out-of-home contracts. So out of home is an incredibly strategically managed business to optimize their revenue growth and continuity. And so I think it's a great space. Press has been in a very different position, because you've got the cannibalization of brand dollars, pounds, euros, whatever. But you've also had the total collapse of the classified small business spend that used to be in press. So that 40% to 7% drop of share of total advertising that the Group M stats highlighted, that the FT quoted, is indicative of that. But there's also been a massive reduction of publishers, in the sense of titles, local, special interest, because they've been replaced by the web-based publishing.
Yes, their innovation, their evolution has been the internet, right? So
exactly.
We have to look at it that way, in the digitization of media, of publishers. And I think as well, if you look at out of home, you're talking about the what decade versus decade the innovation has been in out of home. One thing to look at is the complexity of it as well. Like, from somebody who's my background is fully digital, kind of going in, understanding the more traditional out-of-home industry, and having spent some time in the US doing so last year, it's fascinating how there are still two worlds. And if you are digital and looking to try and get into the out-of-home industry, it's still quite protected, if you like, by the original, the main incumbents of that industry that still really want it to remain a traditional form of media, but with posters. That relates and that's the challenge, right?
That relates to what I was saying, is that they cannot have the contract to sell that inventory placement without a long-term commitment of revenue to secure the right to sell that space. Yeah. So it's entirely in the out-of-home industry's interests to be controlled and protected, because otherwise it financially becomes very, very high risk, which would limit innovation. We know that that's a problem. If you can't anticipate the revenues and predict the revenues forward, then you won't make that investment. Mm. So again, I think it's a great advertising world, the out-of-home space. It has a very important role. Ironically, it's one of the few mediums that now support local advertising. Now, I don't mean local companies, but I mean locally targeted advertising, because so much has gone to a national play. If you think about TV, it's increasingly national rather than regional. ITV and Channel 4 in the UK used to have regional macros that you could buy against. That's diminishing dramatically. US has gone from local cable to much more network cable and broadcast. So again, the opportunity to say, I want to advertise something in Wyoming or Wolverhampton, out of home is one of the few ways that you can do that now with a high degree of certainty that you're going to be well placed, and a tangibility that is one of the challenges we know with digital, particularly display bought through ad networks, is it's hard to know where it's going. So there's a confidence and a clarity about out of home, but at the same time, it's expensive. It's not measurable, and it's high production cost as well. Yeah. So there are negatives, but I think it's a great medium that plays a very important role.
Why is it growing when, like you just mentioned, the one thing I'd be going, I'm just about to spend $5 million on a out of home campaign, and I can't measure it, like, because they have some kind of complex metrics that they use, which I look at it going, this is nonsense. I don't know how this. You know, they were trying to use geo obviously as a tie-in to measure footfall into stores based on, you know, advertising shown on billboards, and that must be. I agree with you that it's amazing they're actually growing so quickly. It's phenomenal. Like, if you think about the other shrinking areas, like in digital, it is all Google and Facebook and some of the platforms. That's not the there's other platforms in digital that are doing pretty well. But I'm always kind of curious how this space can grow at 8% in a year when one of the key fundamentals of it doesn't seem to add up.
It's a bit like the tail wagging the dog. Ultimately,
who's the dog and who's the tail?
So the tail is measurement.
Right.
And essentially, if your goal is that you want to sell a load of product or launch a product and get mass awareness, the measurement is a tool of that outcome. It's not the driver of the strategy.
Okay.
So ultimately, the fact that outdoor measurement is far less granular than digital measurement doesn't mean that if you want to have impact out of home bought with sufficiency of coverage, which could be 2,500 large format sites, 150 spectacular sites, and that will give you a coverage of national. And you can use the poster measurement systems to project what your reach and frequency from that. But the reality is you've got to buy a certain sufficiency of sites to launch a product on out of home. And in digital, you've got to buy a certain sufficiency of reach and frequency using digital measurement. The fact that the digital measurement is much more dynamic doesn't mean that when you're planning and post-campaign analysing, that greater degree of specificity is comparable. So if you've bought enough posters, then you're going to get awareness, and you can measure that with broader brand tracking studies. It won't allow you to understand which locations perform more effectively than others, which digital measurement does allow, but you'll know that you had the right volume. And if it didn't turn into sales, it meant your proposition or your creative was bad. It wasn't down to the media.
Right. Okay.
Do you get that?
I do, but doesn't make any sense to me at all.
No, well, it won't do, will it? Because you're coming at it from a digital perspective and a digital logical.
I mean, this is a reach and frequency. How many billboards do people see in a day? Don't get me wrong. No, but there is definitely a brand recall.
Reach and frequency is only a proxy for were you effective with your communication goals. And your communication goals, the reason that the marketers are spending the money is they want to build saliency and consideration, and they want to shift units out of the store. So again, when you're buying a macro visibility, which would be across media of TV, out of home, some press, maybe some radio and some digital, ultimately, because it's very difficult, as we all know, to unpack the contribution of each component, you're going to look at your sales. If your sales aren't there, you're going to look at a variety of metrics to work out why they aren't there. Is it down to the fact that you priced inappropriately? Doesn't matter what your media and advertising did if you were priced inappropriately, or if there was a competitor with a much more compelling product performance benefit that meant that you lost share. If there is parity in all of those sorts of areas, then start looking into, was it about, did you put your ads in the wrong place, or did you run too lightly? And then you'll go deeper and deeper. And that's my point of tail and wagging.
But if that was the case, why would that get more? Why would the ad a home piece get more than radio and TV, which are kind of just as, I would say, fluffy in terms of the metrics? Like, you know, why would you not put more? Is it more of a case like it feels like there's no real science behind this? It's just because they look at the you look at your CPA on Facebook.
I think many marketing research professionals would say there is a lot of science behind it.
There's no science. They're not scientists.
But again, out of home is doing something different in many cases than digital. It's impact. It's proximity. It's speaking to consumers in a different way. There's something cool about really good out of home, or there's something call to action about six sheets in a supermarket car park if you're launching a new product in the supermarket. They have different goals than other channels. So again, it's what's the purpose, and then how do I measure whether or not the purpose is being achieved? And yes, poster measurement is poor. Again, it doesn't account for, or it might be in an algorithm, but it doesn't dynamically account for, is it raining or not? Is that going to change the number of people on the streets? Is it cloudy and gloomy and foggy and with low number of daylight hours? All of that sort of stuff is not dynamically captured in out-of-home measurement. But the reality is you're using out-of-home with a knowledge base and a confidence that, as I said, 2,500 sites will get you visibility.
Yeah, all right, that's not why you invest in it. That's not why you invest in TV either. Okay, so.
But I'm going to throw a curveball question here, right? So let's just say, if it's growing at 8%, why does it need data driven? What's the point? Like, seriously, it doesn't seem to me like it's doing very badly here. Like, you know, maybe the old curmudgeoners are correct in Idaho. We don't need this data driven fandangle stuff. We're doing pretty well.
Do you mind in terms of measurement, or do you mean programmatic advertising?
Well, they don't like the word programmatic advertising.
They're right not
so
to.
It's not real time. It's not pressure level. So we call it data driven, right? Yeah. Which is probably better.
Or day part driven, or site targeted.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's call it ad served. Let's call it ad served.
Okay, hey. Ad served. That's better. But I like data driven better, because it might suggest there's some kind of science behind it. But why then do we need that when the traditional lad with the bucket of glue and a poster and his white van running around the arsehole of Northern England, because putting up Greg's poster?
The lad with paste and a bucket has been replaced by digital screens or skins that allow for illumination through. There's been an awful lot of innovation. The lad with the bucket is far less prevalent than
still there,
than the digital screens. Yeah. But why would anybody then get into an ad-served model that is suggesting an audience level targeting? It's not there. It's certainly, or it's very immature where it is present, and it's unnecessary complexity.
And also in a GDPR, again, ITP world, and I can come back to this, the ability to link it to mobile data is going to become fucking impossible. Let's be honest with you. And I keep coming back to that same point, like, you know, because they were trying to loop in the data, location data, and it just isn't working on.
I think I've seen it done, and I think it's really interesting where it's done, but it's not. It's one level of analysis alongside many other levels of analysis. I think it's really exciting to look at where consumers' habits can be overlaid, correlated to distribution of sites and potentially EPOS level sales data. I think that's really interesting analysis. But it's, again, it's got to be taken as an analysis area rather than sort of a feed for an algorithm, because I don't think its maturity, its pervasiveness is there for an automated algorithm feed.
Is that pulling money away from somewhere then? If the out-of-home space is growing, is it pulling money? Is this a suggestion that's pulling money from newspapers?
Well, possibly newspapers.
Right. Wow. Publishers really are screwed.
Well, no, because the money in digital is still going up, and that's where most of their revenue comes from now, right? Yeah. They know that. They know that the bottom's fallen out of print, which is why their investment and their time goes into digital now.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, it depends what you're looking at. I mean, ultimately, the publisher's business is content creation.
Yeah.
Previously, their differentiation was often about targeted content, either at an interest or a geography, if you're a publisher in print. So you were the sentinel bugle from some part of the northwest of England. That isn't sustainable. The publisher's business evolves. It's Darwinistic. So it will downsize the number of heads. It will still create content. It will maybe distribute multiple platforms, syndicate, all of that. It's a content business. Mm. Newspapers were always a content business, and the advertising will support whatever content business is at scale and viable. The consumer is the one that loses. The consumer loses the local news from the Sentinel bugle in the Northwest.
Fine newspaper.
Exactly. I think you started your career there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
but that's what's lost. The consumer loses local news in some of these contexts.
Yeah.
But and then they may decide that as a group of consumers, they want to buy that from a startup.
But do you think if innovation, like the innovating piece hit, or the data-driven piece hits out of home, it could see bigger growth? It could be more. Like if you think about the DTC brands, they genuinely love out of home, but they look for an actionable piece. So they'll be, the tube advertising with a code they'll use to sort of track back to the success.
Yeah, but they're two different things. So in the US now, DTC brands are the biggest investors in out of home. But in the UK, the reason that you see so many DTC brands advertising on the tube is because they are in some sort of venture deal with the media owners.
Right.
As a way of getting them to understand how they can build and grow a brand outside of Facebook. And what's happening to the TV there?
Bloomberg has just come on in the background.
Bloomberg came on the TV in the background. That's quite scary.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is down to a venture deal to try to get them to realise the benefits of out-of-home advertising, right, and not just pump their money into Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah.
When they get to a certain size, they will then choose to either go and invest fully in out-of-home or not. But most of those are still quite fairly small-scale DTC brands that are working with the media owners on a venture capital deal.
Yeah.
Which is why they're everywhere.
Yeah, okay.
But will they? But would you see them doing digital in the UK? Yes, when they start scaling more, but still not to the same extent that they do in the US, because they are massive over there.
It's really exciting to see innovation.
Absolutely.
And if we think about it, not all innovation works. I think back to, again, the 90s when cross-track video was something that London Underground was working really hard to introduce, and there are still some projectors on platforms.
Yeah, I've seen one.
That are never used.
Yeah.
And so not all innovation, it sounds sensible. Let's put video into underground stations where people are spending a few minutes waiting for a tube to come in front of them. So, you know, some innovation might sound sensible, it won't work.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. So, again,
what is happening in this room?
Great to have innovation.
Dropping things now. Sorry. It is, absolutely. We're running out of time very, very quickly. Just want to get a quick perspective from you, Anthony, on what you think 2020 will look like and what 2020 holds for this ridiculous industry that we love so much.
So again, continued disruption linked to the whole regulation and its impact on the ability to use data and the value of collecting data for different intermediary layers, whether or not that's the brand, whether or not it's the publisher, whether or not it's a third party sitting in the middle trying to marketplace make. So I think that will continue to be unclear. I think that we will see a continued relatively depressed investment landscape in Europe whilst Brexit continues to bring uncertainty about what to invest, where to invest. I think that we've got a US economy that continues to be pretty strong. So that's a good thing, regardless of the the strange political context.
That's a great way of putting it.
And again, I think Asia is where there's an awful lot of growth. So I think we're going to see, I hope we're going to see some real tech innovation, both on the devices side and on the experiences side, and then also on the ad tech side. I think we still haven't seen sufficient response to the footprint of Asia in terms of digital consumers, in terms of global innovations, in terms of the ad tech space.
Amazing. Anthony's Business Top Tour of 2020. Thank you so much for coming in, Anthony.
Thanks
for
having me.
As always, a wealth of experience and knowledge. Really interesting to have you in, Kieran.
He's so clever.
Thank you. He is extremely clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Far cleverer than you.
Oh, I'm dumb.
If you have to say that, yes. It means you don't really believe it.
It's a Dunning-Kruger effect.
Anyway, Kieran.
I'll explain that off air.
Oh, no. Kieran, thank you.
Lindsay, what a wonderful pleasure it is to be on your podcast.
You're always welcome. Anthony, thank you again. This has been the Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you very much.